Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another wonderful episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife. Today, we're going to be talking about a lot of LGBT history and LGBT issues, both past, present, and possibly even future. My name is Mason, and my pronouns are she, they.
My name is Isabel, and my pronouns are she, her.
I'm Jeremy, my pronouns are he, him, and I think you meant the LGBTQIALMNOP, am I right?
I meant the LGBT cuties, because we're all just so darn adorable.
Damn right.
Factual.
Damn right. but yeah, I figured we could start out this episode by establishing our cred as gays up front. So like I said, my pronouns are she, they. I'm a non-binary trans woman, and I am pansexual. And that means that I don't really care about gender. An attractive person to me is an attractive person.
Yeah, like Mason here, I'm also pan, though I am cis for the most part, so I do lose some credibility there.
Yo, get the fuck out of here.
I'm the token cis. Are here. Oh, yeah,
gross.
Yeah. The token cis guy. No,
I'm just kidding.
I'm contaminating this whole operation.
Yeah, with your straight particles. Not straight, just particles. I'm sorry, I missexualized you. Forgive me.
And I'm a trans woman, and I identify as a pan-lesbian, in that most of the time I find I'm attracted to people who are more feminine-presenting, and that's just how it tends to work, but I can be, I definitely found myself attracted to people across the whole gamut of human expression.
Same. I definitely lean towards more feminine people just in general because they're soft and nice. Right. But yeah, like I can get down with a good like muscly guy every once in a while or something. I don't know.
Taylor Lautner, perhaps?
Yeah, that was my first, like, I guess at the time it would be considered a gay crush because I still thought I was a boy. But, yeah, that was, like, the first time I knew that, like, I was attracted to men.
My longest-standing straight crush would probably be, I can't even think of his name right now. The lead singer from Nine Inch Nails.
Trent Reznor.
Trent Reznor. Yes.
I don't know what he looks like off the top of my head.
Yeah, I like him.
Into that goth, edgy aesthetic.
He's very handsome.
Speaking of grunge of that era, I think one of my first gay crushes would be Kurt Cobain.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was, yeah, great. Fair. Oh, yeah. Kurt was there for a lot of people in the early and mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so today on this episode, specifically what we're going to be talking about is we're going to establish some of the context for the Lavender Scare, and maybe get into the Lavender Scare just a little bit, depending on how much time we have. And this will eventually culminate in the Stonewall Riots and the gay liberation movements following the Stonewall Riots. So I want to say up front, we think about Stonewall as this sort of incident that exists in isolation. It was this one day where a bunch of gay people got together and they decided to have a riot against the police, and this kicked off like decades of like radical queer organizing. But it turns out that there was actually a lot of context going back centuries. I mean, like, gay people have existed for thousands of years, but as far as the, like, current, like, modern American history of LGBT people goes, we will be starting in colonial times.
Yeah, history is complicated, so we don't have the time to go all the way back as far as we can.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we've always been here, right? We just haven't always been written about, and a lot of times when they did write about us, they would hide, they would not acknowledge who we were. I mean, it's one of the most common memes of any of the the lesbian communities out
Sappho and her friend, am I right?
Yeah. Oh, they were roommates. They lived together their whole lives, and they were the best of friends. And that's how so many of us were viewed for a long time, because they didn't want to talk about us. You know what I mean? But they also, like, if they were lucky, if the people were lucky enough to be living in a community where people weren't going out of their way to stick your noses in their business, they were willing to let you live there as long as you weren't open about it.
Yeah. A lot of people throughout history in the LGBT community have sort of led these very secretive, like, private lives, because if they were out and proud about their preferences for partners or their gender, they would be met with a lot of opposition and hostility from the society around them. We're still met with a lot of opposition and hostility. Something I always think back on is the decision in 2015 to allow homosexual marriage on a federal level, and how even though that was a big victory, that was kind of the result of queer communities putting pressure on the government for hundreds of years now.
Right. I think
there's still a lot of reaction, and there's still a lot of people who personally think that, like, we're icky.
Right. But I do think it's important. Like, that's an important aspect of the story, is that decision that made gay marriage legal across the country. It's not even 10 years old yet, right? When did it come about?
2015.
Yeah, it's not even 10 years old. And the struggle that was up to that point was a long and arduous one. And I feel like there's a lot of people, especially the more comfortable people in the queer community, who really don't want to think about that right now.
Yeah.
And we need to, because the kind of challenges that we're facing right now, they all have their roots in this history of queer phobia.
Yeah. And there's always been this this sort of tension among the ruling class, at least in our country, of the good old US of A, where US the liberals want US of gay.
There we go.
But yeah, the liberals want to give us concessions. They want to get us to shut the fuck up by giving us a rainbow flag on a crosswalk or something. Well, the reactionaries, the Republican Party, or basically the fascist party for all intents and purposes, they want to rule through outright fear and terror and legislate us out of existence and into the prison system.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of that in the laws that are coming out now, where they are, for example, like, really strengthening the penalties for different sex offenders, specifically when it comes to children. And just purely on the face of that, that's like, okay, well, why would you have a hard problem with sex offenders getting stricter punishments? And setting aside everything we would want to talk about with the prison industrial complex on that, at the same time that they're doing these things, they're also making it a sexual offense just to exist as a trans person around kids in certain areas.
Yeah. They say that it's about the children, but it's really about targeting adults. Right.
It's about forcing us back into the closet.
Yeah, definitely. As one of my mom's friends said once when I left my phone logged in at the T-Mobile store and somebody made a coming out post for me, go back in the closet and take the tissues with you. Like, that's basically the Republican Party's mindset.
Sometimes it's even more extreme than that.
Yeah, or sometimes it's just straight up genocidal rhetoric, which will eventually translate into policy.
Right, and we're already seeing that play out right now in Florida. The what's happening in Florida is very easily classified as a mid-stage genocide at this point. Tens of thousands of LGBTQIA people have had to flee Florida and face losing all of their medical care and face potentially having their children taken away if they have kids.
Yeah, it's very scary. And, like, all of this comes part and parcel with the attack on reproductive rights. So it's not just a crackdown on us, it's a crackdown on women and people who have wombs more broadly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is part of why history is so important, because what the ruling party wants is to give us these concessions that we spoke on before and have us, you know, let our history books gather dust on the shelf and forget what got us these concessions in the first place, because it takes effort, it takes protest, and it takes some violence to get the system to recognize you, but that's not the end of it. You have to keep pushing, and especially now where they're pushing back at us for no reason, we have to push harder than ever.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I think now that we've covered a little bit about what's going on today, which we will do more of throughout the episode, I think we should cover the context for the Lavender Scare. Okay, so here is the context for the history of LGBT rights in America going back to colonial times. So during colonial times, there were really big three oppressing forces. There was a big three of, like, oppressing forces against the LGBT community. And those were Judeo-Christian values, the medical community, and the third oppressing force was the law. So Judeo-Christian values exercised a pretty immense influence over American society and its institutions just in general. And at this time in history, homosexuality and gayness wasn't really viewed as a crime. It was viewed as a sin, and you were punished accordingly for that. And these would often be, like, very brutal punishments, like medieval stuff, basically, without getting, like, too deep into it. So these Judeo-Christian values exercised such an influence that the medical profession labeled gay people as diseased. Over time, this perception would shift towards a mental instead of physical illness model. But the medical field would, like, feature prominently in the oppression of LGBT people for a very long time. And to wrap that up, the third oppressing force for gay people was the law. Eventually, these values translated into policy, and that policy became very restrictive of gay people. And we'll get more into the specifics of that later. I keep saying that. I should really just read the notes instead of saying we'll get more into that later. So, doctors contributed to a perception that gay men were effeminate and gay men were masked. But yeah, I guess you could call this bioessentialism. Because we are assigning certain set characteristics to different groups of homosexuals. Gay men are considered flamboyant and more feminine and limp-wristed, forgive the phrase. And gay women are seen as more butch, more mask. And if you spend any amount of time with, like, gay people, you come to find that these stereotypes are not true. But these were perpetuated by the medical community, given this model of illness which they were pushing. So around this time in the 17 and the 1800s, the term sodomy came about, which literally means the sin of Sodom. And it came from the biblical story where there were two towns that were very sinful. One was called Sodom and the other one was called Gomorrah. And God just hated the shit out of these towns. So he sent fire from the sky and burned them down. And the people who escaped, if they looked back on the towns, they would turn into a pillar of salt. Very logical stuff. This was like Old Testament God. So, like, he was a petty bitch. But that just kind of links back to the Judeo-Christian values that people were so inundated with at the time. They thought of these things in biblical terms. And there were severe punishments for sodomy including the death penalty, which would be repealed and reinstated throughout history. So in our own history, there is historical precedent for persecuting gay people in this way.
I think that this historical context is, I mean, it's something that people don't really think that it goes back this far. People, if you're out of the LGBT zeitgeist, you kind of think as all of this being something recent, even though the persecution has gone on for obviously even further than where we started here. As long as... Go ahead, Izzy.
I was just going to say, it's like, you're absolutely right, and it really is indicative of... It really challenges that mindset that, oh, well, gays have only been around for, you know, a few decades or something like that. This is only a recent phenomenon where we see people being open about these sorts of things. But the reality is that there were all of the, this persecution existed all the time. There's laws in the books against this sort of thing. They wouldn't have been writing laws against people being this way if they didn't exist. Right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. They recognize that there were people out there that weren't straight and weren't cis. And instead of giving those people an opportunity to just be themselves for a variety of different reasons, they persecuted them.
Yeah. And, like even today, there's a lot of, like, private, like, conversion therapy type stuff going on. And once again, this is nothing new. Back in the day, doctors would look for cures to gayness, ranging from psychotherapy and hypnosis to castration, hysterectomy, lobotomy, electroshock, aversion therapy, and the administration of untested drugs. So our people have really been through the ringer on this. I have known people who have gone through conversion therapy, and it's incredibly traumatizing for them.
Yeah, a lot of people think that this kind of stuff is over already, but a very famous individual, Mr. Mike Electroshock Therapy Pence, was a big proponent of conversion therapy and electroshock therapy.
Yeah.
I believe he remains a proponent of it, does he not?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah, and this is somebody who is still a major player in presidential politics.
The Vice President of the United States.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
currently up on stage at every Republican primary debate, embarrassing himself because he's old and has a horrible campaign strategy.
I don't think he's going to be up power. Anymore, thankfully.
Yeah.
But yes, he still has power. He has influence. People that believe these things have power and influence, and their influence is growing. Like, Pence isn't losing because he's a believer in conversion therapy. If anything, the people that he's losing to are even more extreme.
Yeah. And, like, modern-day conversion therapy, from what I've been told from people who have been through it, they try to hide it under this veneer of everything being very scientific. Like, they'll, like, run imaging tests on your brain where they will show you, like, gay porn and see which areas of your brain light up when you are watching gay porn. And then they will administer electric shocks every time those areas of your brain light up in an attempt to suppress them. It's really grim, disturbing stuff. Like, and it follows people for the rest of their lives, the people who have been through it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's obviously very traumatizing.
Yeah.
And horrifying. I mean, yeah. It's absolutely horrifying.
Mm-hmm. So, something that I feel gets left out of the discussion in the LGBT plus community when it comes to these issues is the actual material conditions that give rise to straightness and the oppression of LGBT plus people, and the material conditions that give rise to homosexual communities and LGBT plus communities. So in colonial times, Colonial people had a traditional family structure out of necessity because you needed your children to work the land for you. You literally had to fuck and have as many children as possible in order for the farm to keep going from generation to generation. However, in the mid-1800s, we had this thing called industrialization. And this gave rise to the modern-day system of wage slavery. But this had an unintended consequence. Oh my god, those fucking dogs. I really hope it's not being picked up on the recording. So yeah, getting back into what we were just talking about. The unintended consequence of wage slavery was that people were suddenly gaining more independence on an individual level because you could sell your labor for a wage, and that wage would cover an apartment, your own food, the things that you need to survive. You weren't tied to the land anymore. And with this new freedom, homosexual communities started to arise. Homosexuality as a category is actually a very recent invention. It emerged around the 19th century because of this industrialization, which was taking place. And in the cities, all of a sudden, we had these bars popping up, which catered to an LGBT clientele. In England, you had, like, Molly houses, which were places where LGBT plus people would meet and have a lot of fun together. And, like, out of these bars and out of these, like, urban-dwelling places, you started getting, like, gay movements. Less so in the countryside, because they were still tied to the land, but more so in the cities, because they had wage labor, and they had public meeting places, really.
Yeah, I mean, the material conditions started to develop to where those communities could find places to be safe, or feel safe, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And being a little bit more out in the open.
Yeah. So, as these gay communities started developing, you had a lot of reaction to these gay communities. So, in the 1870s, laws banning the dissemination of quote-unquote perverted material were put into place, and you could be punished for disseminating any LGBT material, really. In the 1920s...
I was going to say, what was the typical excuses that were used even early on there? For why it was necessary to make these things illegal? What were the things that were being said about gay people then? Was it basically the same as it is now?
That's actually an area that I'm not incredibly well versed on, but we will see as time goes on, these arguments of like, oh, think of the children, all gay people are pedophiles, right, will develop. And, like, from the jump, we were labeled as perverts. We were labeled as on the fringes of society and unacceptable for societal norms.
So from my understanding, it sort of evolves with the times. Like, in the 17th century, it would be tied to heresy and maybe witchcraft, and then, you know, as the current thing that people are angry at changes, and as the material conditions change, people sort of stick it on to different taboos.
That makes those sense. Goddamn lesbian witches.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Like, you don't see people legitimately accusing lesbians of being witches anymore, but that was absolutely a thing that happened back in the day.
Yeah, and not even just the LGBT suffered from that. If you cheated on someone, if you cheated on your husband, you're a witch. So
yeah, nowadays,
but yeah, that's why now it's pedophiles and you know, the traditional family values are being threatened, and you know, whatever.
Nowadays, the lesbians describe themselves as witches and collect rocks.
Yeah, true, and they're based for it.
They're based, yeah. Sometimes I think about the Boxer Rebellion and how there was, like, a strong contingent of people who practiced this, like, obscure martial art in it, which was very mystical. And I think if we can get the Wiccans and the Neo-Paganists on our side, then we could get a lot done.
Let's go.
Yeah. But yeah, by the 1920s, purity activists were chasing people off stage at like plays with gay themes, and there was a theatrical padlock bill which was introduced, which was also banning quote unquote perversion. And that's basically like that's some basic context for the events leading up to the Lavender Scare and the developments in American society which eventually made the Lavender Scare seem necessary to so many people.
Because as everyone knows, banning concepts completely works.
Oh yeah, definitely.
There's never been a history of that failing miserably.
Yes, I would like to ban perversion, please. Oh, what's perversion? Good question. I think it's just whatever I don't like.
Right.
Yeah.
Literally, like, open-end laws like that that don't bother with actually, like, specific details of any. But that's we're already seeing things like that happening right now, too, right? Just tying right back in. We're seeing a lot of these laws that have very broad potential interpretations of what does and doesn't qualify as sexual misconduct in public. And yeah, I mean, that's one of their oldest methods of control, not just for us, but for any marginalized groups.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about the Lavender Scare, and we're giving you a 2-for-the-price-of-1 deal, because not only will we be talking about the Lavender Scare, we will also be talking about the Red Scare, because it's impossible to talk about one without the other.
Right. They basically, the scares kept bleeding over into each other. All the communists were gays, and all the gays were communists, and so forth.
There's that McCarthy quote. Let me find it. Where is it? Yeah, there's that McCarthy quote where he's like, "You will find that practically every communist is twisted mentally or physically in some way." And you know, he's got us. Yeah, we are pretty twisted, folks.
I mean, 2 of the 3 of us are disabled here. I mean,
so yeah,
we've got the physical twisting going on already.
Definitely.
And of course we're twisted. We can't even see straight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This bitch over here has 4 herniated discs. Like,
my spine is so fucked.
Yeah, me too. I feel you. I don't have any herniated discs. I'm just bald, yet. So. That is truly the worst disability. I'm so sorry.
I'm also bald, for the record.
I'm so sorry for both of you.
You know, actually, I'm kind of okay with it at this point. Like, would I prefer, like, having long, flowing locks? Yeah, sure. But what I've got, I've actually made it pretty good for myself, I think.
I've always figured that if I went bald, I'd just start wearing a hat everywhere, and that'll be my new thing. I'll work it into, like, my sense of fashion.
I just look good bald. I don't know what to say.
Fair. So, yeah. The Lavender Scare happened before, concurrently with, and after the Red Scare. Senator Joseph McCarthy, the guy who spearheaded the Red Scare, was elected in 1947, but the roots of the Lavender Scare actually go back much, much further than that. And the roots of the Red Scare go back further than that, for that matter as well. But the Lavender Scare was specifically something that happened, that started in 1950, and it was a reaction to suspected homosexuals holding government offices. And the campaign that they would go on against homosexuals would last well into the 1970s. It was official government policy to fire anybody suspected of being a homosexual up until the 1970s, which is remembered as like a fairly progressive time. It's so bizarre how we whitewash history, like smooth over the corners and whatnot. So the Lavender Scare, it primarily affected men, but it also affected lesbians, which should go without saying. But it was really, like, like, in the conservative mind, a homosexual man is way more icky than a lesbian woman, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I think that goes to speak on how patriarchal our society is, because since it's a kink for some straight men, that it's more acceptable in the public eye.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, something that we wanted to discuss was that this Lavender Scare didn't just come out of nowhere. There were, like we established, there were growing industrial cities at the time. New York, Chicago, and San Francisco specifically being very big gay hubs. But another big gay hub was that... that sounds like a nickname, Big Gay Hub.
Big Gay Hub.
I was literally just thinking that as well.
But another big gay hub was Washington, D.C., which grew significantly between the years of 1930 and 1942 due to the New Deal era programs. And we have a quote here from The Lavender Scare, The Cold War Persecution of Gays and Lesbians in the Federal Government by David K. Johnson. It reads, "The total population of the metropolitan area doubled, from approximately 700,000 in 1930 to 1.4 million in 1950, while the number of federal workers in the city increased fourfold, from 70,000 in 1930 to a peak of 270,000 by 1942. During the war years, 5,000 new government workers arrived each month, creating an unprecedented housing shortage. Many of the new arrivals were young, single people looking for entry-level clerical positions." So, once again, this didn't just come out of nowhere. You had these huge influxes of people leaving the countryside and going into the cities. And there were a lot of good, well-paying, like, government jobs available. And a lot of LGBT people and a lot of women would flock towards these clerical positions, which had just opened up.
I was going to say, these were largely also, like, college-educated people as well, weren't they?
They were, yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically like a lot of the country's, quote-unquote, best and brightest were all flocking to the same area.
Yeah, definitely. What we had was really, like, a blossoming of the LGBT community. There's actually a rather lengthy quote from the book that I was just reading that I'd like to read, because I think it really illustrates like the sort of scene that existed in Washington, D.C. at the time. So I wanted to highlight the story of Ladd Forrester real quick. Ladd Forrester was a young gay man who moved to Washington, D.C. and worked and got a job at one of the New Deal agencies. So, here's the quote. "Like many of his fellow entry-level federal workers, he enrolled in classes at nearby George Washington University. While standing in line to sign up, I got into a conversation with Ronald, a most attractive junior classman," Forrester recalled. "Ronald invited him to a dance that night, held in a former stable behind two Victorian townhouses on P Street. When he arrived, he heard a three-piece orchestra playing Shine On Harvest Moon, and saw young men like myself dancing together cheek to cheek. There were women dancing together too, but Forrester was more captivated by the many brunette men with their hair swept up and tinted with gold. It was a party the likes of which I could never have imagined possible," Forrester remembered years later. "As I stood there, I suddenly thought, here I am, 20 years old, I have a job in the capital of the United States, a place to live that's my own, and a new friend who has brought me to this glamorous party. I cannot hold back tears." Soon after, Forrester attended a lesbian wedding at the home of a minister from one of the city's more prominent congregations. The traditional wedding cake was topped with two female dolls holding hands. Like Forrester, the two brides had come to Washington to work in the new government agencies. For all of them, the New Deal meant more than economic opportunity during hard times. It meant a new way of life. And this was all going on in the 1930s. This chapter is actually called This Used to Be a Very Gay City. Before,
that's a spectacularly evocative quote.
It is. It's
right.
It's really beautiful. Like, it's like the society that we could have if we were just met with acceptance instead of hostility is so wonderful.
It really is. And, like, I can't speak for y'all, but, like, I definitely understand to a degree some of those emotions that were being expressed there. Because there's definitely been times since I've come out where I have found myself in situations where I felt that feeling of acceptance and belonging that I never felt before. And it's wonderful. It's genuinely wonderful. And it's how everyone should be allowed to feel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Agreed. Just like all the specific details in it, it just seems like a fantastic time to be alive as a gay person, and that only makes the Lavender Scare like sting that much more. Because they did their best to eradicate this whole like scene from their cities. But yeah, during this time, the public sector was actually very progressive, more progressive than the private sector, and they integrated women decades before the private sector did. So there's something to be said about state-run agencies being more democratic and inclusive than, like, private agencies. Owned, yeah. But yeah, the feminized clerical jobs were attractive to young gay men, and then they moved in. I have a note here that says those gentrifying gays, and while I took this note a long time ago and I don't have very much about it, there was this place called Lafayette Square, which was one block away from the White House, which was a famous gay meeting place. And as these gay people moved in, they would kind of do so at the expense of the people who are already living there, because gentrification is a thing that happens as an area gets nicer. It gets more expensive because everything is a product to be bought in under a capitalist society. And yeah, it really transformed the whole area. Not necessarily for the better, because it displaced a lot of people, but there were opportunities for gay people to be themselves here, and they really flocked to that. So it's complicated.
There is an interesting discussion to be had about this sort of LGBT gentrification, because I live in Massachusetts, so I'm very close to the famous location known as P-Town, or Provincetown, which is on the arm of Cape Cod, on the east coast of Massachusetts, where it's a predominantly gay city, but it's very, very high class and expensive to live there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this just comes back around to how the restrictions against gay people have, it's still about class, right? If you're wealthy enough, it doesn't fucking matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter what other people think about you. If you're rich enough, right, you could get away with it because you can pay your way through anything.
Yeah, I mean, no one's trying to muscle in on P-Town and you know,
right,
straighten the area up, you know, it's
right,
because they're wealthy.
Right, and this is, yeah, one of those areas where class underlies everything, right, in terms of, like, that doesn't mean that rich gay people don't experience homophobia, because they absolutely do, but it does mean that they have tools available to them, not available to the rest of us, to deal with that. And usually that comes at the expense of, usually, wealth of that level always comes at the expense of other people.
Right.
Definitely. And, like, another thing, too, is, like, once the American government really starts cracking down on LGBT people, there's going to be a lot of people who will be able to afford to just flee the country. And those are people who I'd say have less skin in the game than, like, somebody who doesn't have that luxury.
Their other privileges almost not quite overshadow, but very much diminish the persecution that they face.
Exactly. Yeah. All of this is not to say that, like, we are homophobic against rich people. but like,
speak for yourself.
But like, there still is a conversation to be had about the kind of privilege that wealth affords you. Like, I, for one, I've met many gay people who do not have particularly radical politics, and they almost always have a job as like a programmer or something where they're making six figures a year, and they are just doing fine. I've especially like gay liberals from Canada, because they think like, oh, the persecution of LGBT people will never happen here, or from like Europe or whatever. But like, there's actually historical precedent for it happening in those places, because during the Lavender Scare in America, we used our power in NATO to pressure the other NATO countries into having their own Lavender Scare. So, what I'd like to say is that, like, regardless of your income bracket, your level of wealth, your social class in society, if you're gay, they're coming for you too. Like, they really are.
Like, being wealthy, or even just being comfortable, shields you from a lot of the early stage problems that start coming up from times like this. Because if you're if you're comfortable enough, you can choose where you live. If you're comfortable enough to choose where you live, you have a bit more direct control over the laws impacting you than, say, someone who can't choose where they live. Someone who says,
it removes you from the sphere of influence.
Right. We currently see tens of thousands of people fleeing Florida, and I don't blame those people at all, for the record. And I don't think those people, I think those people probably understand largely better than most the true stakes at hand right now. But there's tens of thousands more who can't do that.
Yeah. We really have to be thinking about everybody, like, going forward.
Yes, we have to stop ignoring huge segments of the population just because the solutions to those issues aren't convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, we live in a time where especially wealthy gays will be more willing to help each other out rather than just segregate themselves to the areas.
Mm-hmm.
You saw a lot of outreach when it came to trans people fleeing their states in the South when these different anti-trans laws started being passed.
And there's some great mutual aid networks that are being established as well. People are trying to do their best to help people. We're trying to do our best to help each other. But there's only so much we can do because so many of us are also working with very few resources available to us as it is.
But yeah, so... like I was saying before we got on that tangent, which was a good tangent, I'm glad we got on it, was that Lafayette Square, which was just one block away from the White House, was a famous gay meeting place. Ladd Forrester, the person who we were just discussing in that quote earlier, said that we would roller skate holding hands and the park police never interfered. There were also places like the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA, where a lot
of... Hey, careful, we're going to get DMCA'd.
DMCA. But yeah, it was pretty fun to stay at the YMCA because you could meet a lot of gay guys there. And, you know, get a clean shave, you can have a good meal, you can do what the fuck you feel. And there were
you can fuck
and there were a lot of bars that catered to a predominantly gay clientele, although they were still segregated by race, because this was the 30s and the 40s, so of course it was still like that.
Play the sad sound effect there.
Wah, wah.
That's rather fascinating to me that somehow it fascinates me, like, how can you live through that persecution and then just go ahead and immediately inflict it on another group of people without like any self-awareness whatsoever?
Yeah,
that's what happens in hyper individualistic societies.
Yep. You meet so many like racist gay people, it's not good. Yeah. But yeah, World War II was actually very good for gay people because there was the discovery of penicillin, which lessened the consequences of venereal diseases. And then in 1948, there was a study put out by Dr. Alfred Kinsey called Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. And this study claimed that 37% of men had engaged in homosexual acts. So, like, at this point, like, how could you make the argument that it's unnatural to engage in these things when a not insignificant minority of people are just naturally doing it and want to do it? Like, there's nothing in nature that says that being straight is the only way of doing something or being gay is the only way of doing something.
No. Honestly, in terms of, like, arguments, the nature one has probably been one of the weakest because they try to boil all of attraction down to pure reproduction, and that doesn't work. That doesn't really doesn't work for humans. That doesn't even work for most of the animal kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if it was about reproduction, you wouldn't have mating calls that, like, the females of a species wouldn't pass down other males. They would just go for whoever's nearby and convenient, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's clearly, even between straight interactions, there's differentiation, there's variation. It's not cut and dry.
Right. Yeah. And, like, while a lot of times that variation is about, you know, picking out and selecting, you know, good traits, you know, looking for a mate that is healthy and so forth, it's also not always about that, though, either. There's been so many indications or times where we've been observing animal species and we see mating, we see the mate in ways that we don't understand. We see them pick mates that we don't understand why they picked them because it didn't seem like they were necessarily the best. But there's
If everything was perfectly set up for evolutionary trait selection, then animals wouldn't naturally go extinct.
Right. It's just, that's not how the world works. Period. It's more complex than that. People need to get out of this idea that the world is an incredibly simple place, because it's not. So, I can't remember what the hell I was saying now, so I think we should just come back to this with, okay, we had a bit of a hiccup there, we had a cat issue that we had to solve, so we're back.
There's a cat like under my bed, he's in a box, my mom was freaking out, it's whatever.
It's a whole deal, it's a whole deal. But yeah, I can't remember what I was saying, so we'll just proceed.
We will just proceed. So, we just covered the Kinsey study, and by the way, like, when this study came out, it was huge fucking news. Like, every dumbass on the street knew about it because they were like, what? You're saying that a man's can touch another man's? And everybody was just like, the gay people were just like, yes, a man can touch another man. But everybody was like, whoa, that's crazy. So yeah, like, everybody knew about this study. It was a huge deal. There was also a gay, like, literary movement. There was authors like Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams and W.H. Auden, and later people like Allen Ginsberg, who were a part of a homosexual artistic and literary movement where they explored gay themes in their stories and poems, mostly through subtext, but sometimes explicitly. And they did a lot to push the culture forward towards more acceptance of these people. However, around the late 40s, so, 1947, the media became filled with stories of sex crimes by perverts, quote-unquote, and quote-unquote aberrant males. There was also a movie that came out in 1948 called Rope, directed by, I almost called him Tennessee Williams again, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And this movie featured...
You mix up Tennessee Williams and Alfred Hitchcock?
I was looking at the name Tennessee Williams at the
moment. Oh, okay. Because it's in my notes. Okay, I was just like, How? What? I was just curious. Yeah. Like, I was just startled for a second. Like, I'm curious where the connection is. Okay.
Yeah. Never mind. Brain that working, makes, Mason.
That makes a lot more sense. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, there was also this movie called Rope, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It's kind of an interesting movie in terms of, like, how it's talked about, because the screenplay was written by a gay man. But by a lot of today's standards, it would be considered problematic and outright harmful in some ways, because it features this gay couple who has just gotten done strangling one of their friends with rope and killing him. And then they decide to host a dinner party over his dead body, because they are just devilish gays. And there's a character played by Jimmy Stewart who's supposed to be a stand-in for, like, Oscar Wilde, like, you know. I was watching, like, interviews with people who worked on Rope, and they were saying how Jimmy Stewart was miscast because, like, he was supposed to be, like, King Gay, but they just got the dude from, like, the Christmas movie where he's like, I don't want to, it's a wonderful life. But yeah, like, all of this media that was coming out and all of these stories about perverts and aberrant males eventually translated into a lot of public sentiment against LGBT plus people, and sex crime laws were proposed. The big one being the Miller Sexual Psychopath Law, which criminalized consensual homosexual behavior between adults. And we have another quote from The Lavender Scare, The Cold War Persecution of Gays and Lesbians in the Federal Government by David K. Johnson. And it says, the first two arrests under the new sodomy statute were of a 30-year-old African-American man and an 18-year-old white sailor who were apprehended on the mall in an apparently consensual encounter. They were held on a $1,000 bond. Prior to the passage of the Miller Act, such persons would have been charged with disorderly conduct, required to post a $25 bond, and released. Although the focus was mainly on the threat posed by men, women were also occasionally charged with sodomy. At a downtown hotel in 1949, a 29-year-old D.C. woman and a 27-year-old Baltimore woman were charged with sodomy and placed under a $500 bond. The risks of engaging in homosexual sex in the District of Columbia had significantly increased.
That's just...
I'd like to...
Wait, when did that law come into effect? I'm sorry.
1949.
I believe. So it is fascinating to me, basically, that this country's government basically functioned on gay people, like, keeping everything working during the war.
Yeah.
That's an aspect of this. It's fascinating to me. Especially as much as this country really glorifies World War II in every single way it can.
Yeah, definitely. The real people who kept shit running and did the labor required to run a country are just kind of glossed over. Yeah. Like, we tend to think about history in terms of kings and queens. We think we blame everything on the president, or on your least favorite senator or congressperson, and there's very little thought to the people, or given to the people who are on every level of society, like, operating to keep shit running and to actually do the work that's required of them.
Right. Yeah. The country doesn't run on just its president, or any large organization doesn't just run on the top of it, the most visible part of it, without the day-to-day functionaries doing their part, it can't function. And I think it's a fascinating story in this country's history that during this glorious war that we were fighting, not only did we see units of, say, segregated units of blacks and Japanese perform just extraordinary feats during their service, but we also saw the gay community flock into DC and in a large part, play a large part in keeping the government functioning during this time as well. And then immediately when everyone got back, what happened?
Yeah.
It's something that's not really talked about. Things have gotten a little better now regarding the role that women played during World War II, keeping businesses running and everything right. afloat. But no one mentions the gay community.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows who Rosie the Riveter is, but you'll never see anything about a gay man in DC.
Right.
I really felt like this history had been hidden from me when I was learning about it. Like, I remember tearing up a little bit when I heard, when I first read the description of Washington, D.C. in the 1930s, and how there were fucking lesbian weddings in the 1930s, yeah. attended by large congregations of people, yeah. and then the majority of American society just turned against them. And it's because it came from the top. It's the propaganda machine. It's reactionary values. It's people who have no business making laws regarding our bodies, putting out a campaign to get the public on their side.
Well, and it's beneficial to the ruling class in general to have these sorts of things happening, because the more they can focus people on fighting amongst other people in their same class, the less people will be focused on the harm that the ruling class is doing to them.
Exactly. It's and the woke that's making my job
yeah,
suck.
That's why we see this perpetual cycle for hundreds of years now. And yeah, we're not experiencing anything new right now, unfortunately. But we are experiencing something terrifying.
Yeah, definitely. So the larger sort of coordinated effort against LGBT people in Washington, D.C. was deemed the Pervert Elimination Campaign. So LGBT people were targeted for harassment by police in their cruising areas. The police weren't able to bring them before a judge, but they held them just long enough to collect fingerprints and mugshots. This info was added to a pervert file, and about four times as many men were arrested than women. And then, in 1950, there was this guy named John Purifoy. He was an American diplomat and ambassador. He was actually the ambassador to Guatemala during the 1954 coup. BSAS episode on that coming eventually. basically, in 1950, he just went, "By God, these bitches gay! And they're in the government!" So all of a sudden, gay people were classified as security risks. And the three main categories for this were drunkards, criminals, and homosexuals. And now we're going to get into, why the government was doing this. Because it wasn't a unanimous thing. This was something that was weaponized by particular segments of the ruling class for particular reasons. So the Republicans used the presence of gay people in the government as a way of discrediting the Roosevelt-Truman bureaucracy and to drum up support for McCarthy and other Republicans. And they were very ruthless about this. There was an estimated one LGBT person fired per day. There was the dismissal of nearly 6,000 workers. And gays and lesbians were the only groups in America who were barred from federal employment.
Wow. And in response to what? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Just existing.
It just existing. It was an easy community that they could paint a target on to prevent any kind of social mobilization. Because underpinning all of this, and this is why it ties into the Red Scare so much, was that there was still ongoing socialist and communist movements going on here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the efforts of undermining those movements was absolutely things like the Lavender Scare.
Absolutely. And Like, there were examples of radical queer communist organizations forming, like the Madison Society, which we will be covering in our next episode. But, yeah, so, like, we see a very similar thing happening today, where there is a growing class consciousness among the American population, and that means that you know you're getting fucked over by your boss, basically. So a lot of people are moving to the left, and a lot of the people on the left are members of the LGBT community. I remember I met this guy once that I hung out with, and he was like, oh, you're a communist, you're angry, and you're trans. Like, that makes sense.
fucking tanky.
He was cool.
Okay, good.
He was chill about it.
Actually, I get called tanky almost every fucking day by someone, though. It's actually really amusing at this point.
Yeah, the first time I got called a tanky online, I was just like, yes, it's happened. Finally.
That's me.
That's me.
Tanky is the new commie. It's like that old communist said when I was in the anti-war protest movement for Iraq War II back in the early aughts. If you ain't been called a commie, have you even done anything?
Exactly.
You know, so at this point, if you ain't been called a tanky, have you even done anything?
Yeah. Everybody gets called a tanky who has, like, even vaguely radical politics. Like,
if you're left of Ronald Reagan at this point, you're getting called a tanky by someone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, that quick aside aside, the reason why the Republicans did this was because they wanted power. They wanted to discredit the Democrats. They wanted to undermine their authority and their power in government, and it's not like we're particularly big fans of social democracy, but the social democracy create or the social democratic conditions found in a lot of cities created an environment where gay people could really flourish, and the Republicans weaponized this underlying like view of homosexuality rooted in Judeo-Christian values and the medical community and legal practices to get their guy in power. And later on, like Dwight D. Eisenhower, who ran on a campaign slogan of "Let's clean house," which basically meant let's get all the gays and the commies out of the government, won the presidency. So, like, once again, people in power hold these regressive, reactionary views, and it's up to us to do something about it, because, at least nowadays, like, the Democrats aren't really going to fight against this at all.
No, they haven't been fighting it against it at all.
Because it furthers... Oh,
damn it.
That was perfect. You can go first, go ahead.
Thanks, Jeremy. No, they're not going to fight against it, because at this point, what's left of the National Democratic Party is in the business of, it's completely in the business of de-radicalization more than anything else.
They're playing for the same side,
right,
basically.
Right, they are not interested in getting, in securing people's human rights. What they're interested in is making sure that people's concerns about human rights don't spill over into anything other than vote blue no matter who campaigns.
Yeah, they're trying to avoid radical action.
Right.
And also maybe make some change on the side from our community.
Right, and then at the same time use any excuse, any reason, like any time we push back, such as, for example, like this isn't from the queer community, but the uprisings that occurred in 2020 in reaction to the murder of George Floyd. We saw Democrats use those uprisings as a long-term excuse to dramatically increase police funding and militarization in all of the major cities across the country. And while at the same time paying lip service to the movement itself by doing things like painting streets with Black Lives Matter, which is nice, it's a nice message, but it doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah. It doesn't materially improve the conditions of the people who are living under occupation by the police in the ghettos.
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say. It doesn't improve their material conditions at all.
Yeah. So just a few more things.
Well, Jeremy, did you have something you wanted to say, Jeremy?
No, we had the same idea.
Oh, okay.
So just a few more things before we start wrapping up. I took down some funny things the Republicans said because they sound very reminiscent of like things we hear today. They called the Fair Deal administrations the Fairy Deal administrations.
Oh, wow.
And they coined this term called the Homintern, which was meant to be like the Comintern, you know, the big international organization.
The Homosexual like, International.
Yeah. And like, the term Homintern would actually see use by the gay poet W.H. Alden, probably kind of ironically, because it's just funny.
It's a fucking dog shit term. It's funny, of course.
let's reclaim it. I say we start Homosexual International right here. Let's go.
Hell yeah.
Okay, Homintern and Fairy. Honestly, the Fairy Deal, it's pretty good. We should use that too.
Yeah. And they also called Washington a femocracy, which you see a lot of that rhetoric today as well.
Right. Well, that's mm-hmm. and that ties directly in with misogyny, which is like, oh, if anything's feminine, it must be inferior in some way or something to be looked down upon because modern conservative cis men are literally the most insecure human beings in their own bodies I've ever met. And I was a closeted trans person for like 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's rough. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks that anytime that this community shows outward circumstantial communal happiness, it has to be shut down.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and we get told, you went too far. You went too far. What does that even mean?
Yeah.
What does that even mean? We were existing too openly for you? Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, we'll get into later, like, stuff with the Stonewall riots and how, like, even a lot of, like, LGBT people at the time condemned those because there was this pressure to present yourself as a respectable LGBT person. Basically, I'm gay, but I'm not an F slur. Mentality.
You still see that today.
There's a lot of if you'll forgive the term, pick-me's at this point amongst the gay community, especially the gay community, it seems. But still some in the lesbian community as well. That you see LG without the T or LGB without the T, that sort of thing. And they're trying to distance themselves from the trans community because they see the writing on the wall for us and they figure, hey, if we show that we're on their side with the trans people, then the leopards eating people face party won't eat our face.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as the segregation racially back in the day.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think now is the time to start wrapping up and giving our closing thoughts on this subject. Personally, when I look back on this history, I feel very validated, but also very scared for the future because I know that gay communities can flourish. I know that there are examples of us getting together and making a difference in the world and speaking truth to power and protesting and even rioting and partaking in revolutionary action. But at the same time, I am very cognizant of the fact that this will be met with a lot of reaction. And the government tends to clamp down on the most marginalized groups when those groups seem like they are close to threatening power. They will give us certain victories to placate us and make us... They're basically just handing down little treats. They passed federal legal gay marriage in 2015, but they never codified that on a federal level. That's just a Supreme Court decision, which can be overturned by the now conservative majority on the Supreme Court, because Trump rammed through, was it three different Supreme Court judges, or was it two?
It was at least two.
It was at least two. But yeah, Trump rammed through a number of Supreme Court judges during his time in office, and something that was, it was very instructive, because we all realized that the Republicans know how to wield power and the Democrats don't. Yes. If the Democrats were really interested in maintaining power, Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably would have stepped down during the Obama years, so Obama could have picked another liberal justice, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg died in what, 2020?
To hang around just in case there was another indigenous community she could fuck over.
Exactly. But yeah, she died in 2020, and it was the best day of Mitch McConnell's life. It was the best day of Trump's life, because they got to put their fucking rapist candidate, allegedly, through. And it's just, it makes me scared for the future, but also kind of excited for what's going to come, because when things get really hard for people like us, we start to organize and we are capable of kicking some ass.
Yeah. And if you're wondering what you should be doing right now in response to all this, that's probably the first thing you should be thinking of right now, is organizing with people you trust. Start establishing a community of your own, if you're not already in one, and start establishing a network of your own, and we'll have to go from there.
Yeah.
And all I have to say is, gay people bad, straight people good, please don't kill me.
Of course the cis person would say that.
Of course. Throwing us under the bus as usual.
Oh my god.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone. We'll see you all next time, when we'll be covering the radical organizations that popped up in response to the Lavender Scare, and maybe the Stonewall Riots, depending on how much time we have. No promises. But until next time, we will see you later.
See ya.
Ta-ta.